Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yaki reporting. Death of Afghan Taliban leader confirmed. The Afghan intelligence agency has confirmed that Taliban leader Akhtar Mansoor was killed in an airstrike in Pakistan near the Afghan border. Pakistan says it was informed by the U.S. after the drone strike was carried out, but lashed out at Washington for violating its sovereignty. Islamabad did not immediately confirm that Mansoor was killed. Meanwhile, doctors in Quetta have confirmed receiving two bodies from the remote border region, the scene of the U.S. strike. Reporter Ayaz Ghul is in Islamabad.
This is a significant action that the United States has taken, and it is likely to fuel tensions between the U.S. and Pakistan, as the relationship is already facing strains recently. So it is quite a big deal in that sense.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said today that Mansoor was targeted because he posed an imminent threat to U.S. personnel, Afghan civilians, and Afghan security forces, and that Mansoor was directly opposed to peace negotiations. U.S. President Barack Obama is on a trip to Vietnam and Japan, his 10th trip to Asia since taking office. White House officials say the president's visit is intended to demonstrate the ongoing U.S. commitment to rebalancing relations with the nations of Asia and the Pacific region. His travel also is expected to increase U.S. diplomatic, economic, and security engagement with those countries and peoples. He arrived in Vietnam today. Experts say 41 years after the end of one of the most divisive wars in American history, ties between the U.S. and Vietnam have never been closer. We invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. From Washington, this is VOA News. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi warned the media today against speculating about what brought down Egypt Air Flight 804 and said all scenarios are being considered. In his first public remarks since Thursday's plane crash, he said the investigation could take a long time, but said as soon as investigators find the answers, the public will be informed. Egypt Air Flight MS-804 crashed in the Mediterranean Sea on its way to Cairo from Paris, killing all 66 people on board. Investigators said on Saturday that smoke was detected in the cabin minutes before the plane crashed, though the signals gave no indication as to what caused the fire. On Monday, the people of Britain will decide whether the UK remains part of the European Union or not. The supporters and opponents of the referendum have been campaigning aggressively. Prime Minister David Cameron supports remaining a part of the EU.
Isolationism has never served this country well. Whenever we turn our back on Europe, sooner or later, we come to regret it.
Those who want the UK to leave the EU spent part of the weekend on a bus tour of the country. Nigel Farage is a leader of the anti-EU activists.
We want our passports back. We want our borders back. We want our country back. There we are. Easy peasy.
And the battle for votes ahead of the June 23rd referendum has drawn in U.S. President Barack Obama, EU leaders, and the International Monetary Fund. The IMF has warned of a potentially severe global market reaction to a leave vote, while G7 finance ministers meeting in Japan this weekend warned of the prospect of a worldwide financial shock. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has hailed Myanmar's transition to democracy, but urged his new civilian-led government to continue its work on implementing key reforms meant to improve developments and human rights. We strongly support the democratic transition that is taking place here, Kerry told reporters in a joint news conference with Aung San Suu Kyi during his one-day visit to the capital. The key to the lifting of the remaining sanctions is really the progress that is made within Myanmar in continuing to move down the road of democratization, he said. Kerry's visit came days after Washington lifted various financial and trade sanctions imposed on the country. Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton are locked in a virtual dead heat, with a majority of U.S. voters viewing both of them unfavorably, according to the latest public opinion polls. One poll released today, the Washington Post ABC News survey showed Trump with a narrow edge, while an NBC News Wall Street Journal poll had Clinton with a slight lead. Both polls showed, as other surveys have in recent days, Trump gaining ground on Clinton after becoming the presumptive Republican presidential nominee in early May. The Post survey showed registered voters giving Trump, a brash real estate mogul, a 46-44% edge over Clinton. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
They are anxious and apprehensive about the credibility and the credentials of this Dubai-based company.
Opposition parties in Zambia call for the postponement of the upcoming August 11 general election until the Electoral Commission addresses all of their concerns.
When you read our constitution and the penal code, what is alleged to have done and what is charged with are radically different positions.
A former Ugandan Supreme Court judge says the government's decision to twice charge the main opposition leader, Dr. Kizza Besigye, with treason has no constitutional basis.
Because the region was tragically impacted by the insecurity on the one hand and the extreme violence by the other hand, it was very important to try to create a new dynamic.
And Boko Haram continues trying to recruit more militants in neighboring Cameroon. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zambian opposition political parties are demanding the postponement of the upcoming August 11 general election. This after they kicked against the decision of the Electoral Commission to award a contract to a Dubai-based company to print the ballot papers to be used for the polls. Winter Kabimba, presidential candidate for the opposition Rainbow Party, told me opposition groups want the Electoral Commission to address all of their concerns before the elections to ensure the polls are transparent and credible.
The six opposition political parties that have paid their nomination fees have raised the concern and apprehension about the insistence by the Electoral Commission of Zambia to print the ballot papers in Dubai. They are anxious and apprehensive about the credibility and the credentials of this Dubai-based company. The Electoral Commission of Zambia has advanced the reasons as to why, through the tender process, they decided to settle for the Dubai company. One of them was the issue of the security of the ballot papers. But they have failed to satisfy opposition political parties that the previous company that printed ballot papers for all these years in South Africa, has he printed ballot papers that did not meet the security specifications of the government or the Electoral Commission of Zambia.
The opposition groups, you inclusive, have called for the postponement of the election. On what basis? Because the Electoral Commission has already gone ahead to ensure that this Dubai-based company prints the ballot paper. So it's neither here nor there. Election will go on as scheduled by the Constitution.
There is an impasse. It can't be a question of the fact that it's neither here nor there. We are the stakeholders as opposition political parties. This is not an election for the ECZ and by the ECZ. This is our election. And therefore, if we raise concerns ourselves as stakeholders, we do expect the Electoral Commission of Zambia to address those concerns. You know, to answer your question, by way of extension, we did raise the following issues with the Electoral Commission of Zambia. One, that voters register is fraught with the names of foreign nationals, and this matter is in the hands of the police. So we can't proceed to an election without this matter being addressed to the satisfaction of all the stakeholders. We brought to the attention of the ECZ that there is a misallocation of certain voters from one polling station to another polling station. The provision of voters' register is full of errors in terms of entries, in terms of the particulars of voters. Point number four that we raised was that they have created 202 electoral wards. We don't know where these wards are. We don't know the polling station that these wards contain.
But Mr. Kabimba, with this demand or call for the postponement of the election, doesn't this contravene the Constitution, which calls for the election to be organized by the Electoral Commission, which is the sole body mandated by the or empowered by the Constitution to organize this election?
I agree with you. I agree with you, Peter, but this is the problem of third world countries trying to, you know, to copycat, you know, practices from other countries when you do not have the capacity to manage or to administer or to prepare for an election, you know, fully. You can't fix a date of an election in the Constitution. The problem that we had with the pronouncement of the date for an election was that that was left to the discretion of the president of the ruling party, which president is himself or herself a participant. We argued that the date must be left with the Electoral Commission of Zambia so that when they are ready with everything, like the issues that I've enumerated, then they can pronounce the date for an election. That was the only contentious issue about it.
So what is the next line of action for opposition groups or stakeholders?
The ECZ, Peter, said at the end of that meeting, the ECZ said they accepted our concerns, that they were genuine. They'd be given time to go and look at these concerns and see how they can fit them within the time scale of the election calendar which they have. And they promised us and undertook to us that they would get back to us. We are waiting for the ECZ to give us the answer over these issues. So that's where we are now. So the ball is not in our court. The ball is in the court of the ECZ.
Winter Kabimba is the presidential candidate for the Zambian Opposition Rainbow Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The Ugandan government has twice charged main opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye with treason. This as Besigye was seen on a video clip being sworn in. It came a day before President Yoweri Museveni was officially sworn in as president. The video clip was widely distributed on social media platforms, prompting the government to shut down all social media communications, citing security concerns. But Justice George Kanyihamba, a retired Supreme Court judge, told me the treason charges against the opposition leader are not supported in the Ugandan Constitution.
It is another case, certainly, because when you read our Constitution and the Penal Code, what he is alleged to have done and what he is charged with are radically different positions. The law is very clear. It sets out in greater detail and with the definitive words what it is to commit treason. Now, what he has been charged with is apparently something that was seen on social media. Swearing in falsely or otherwise, it is nowhere written that is a criminal offense in Uganda. What is treason? Is to organize, militarily or otherwise, to overthrow a constitutionally constituted government of Uganda.
Some of his supporters are saying these charges are politically motivated to silence him for good because he appears to have been a thorn in the flesh of the powers that be. Now, as a Ugandan and as a former Supreme Court justice, what is your analysis of the situation on the ground about this?
I think many people in Uganda do not accept that the Supreme Court judgment was in conformity with what happened on the ground. It has been very severely criticized by jurists, others, forget about political scientists, but mutual people. So many Ugandans do not respect what the decision was all about. Many of us have written about it, challenging especially its unanimity, that considering what had happened before, what had happened, the ghastly malpractice that had happened in the party itself, which eventually won the election, the NRM, where even the president himself complained there had been rigging within his own party. For the Supreme Court to say the election was free and fair and the president was free elected is very skeptical very few Ugandans, including those who support the ruling party, don't respect that judgment.
He has called recently, in the last few days, on his supporters to keep up the fight. Now, this NRM supporters are saying is akin to him trying to make the country ungovernable, undermine the stability and peace that Ugandans enjoy, and that they say he is just somebody who incessantly wants to cause trouble and destabilize the country, and that he deserves what is coming to him. What is your take on that?
I saw on TV, I'm not in America, I saw some people who don't want candidate Trump to be president. There was a scuffle, they were shouting and so forth. Have they committed treason against your constitution? Anybody who is the right to demonstrate, the right to assemble, is guaranteed by our constitution. So if he's calling upon his supporters to rally against democratic decisions, against violations of his rights, and please fight against this injustice, that is not treason. And that is not a statement for which you can be charged to say you are trying to destabilize the government. In every dictatorship, in every authoritarian regime, anyone who raises a finger against injustice, anybody who talks about injustice, is of course regarded as trying to destabilize government. And there is no truth in that. If President Museveni and your party wants peace in this country, these 5 years were started, you negotiate with him and other opposition parties. And that is the core in Uganda. So if Ugandans knew that what he has done is wrong, or that the government is correct, why would they be calling for a dialogue? This dialogue was equally called by all the international observers who came to show elections. They saw the irregularities were so much, they believed that without peace talks between Chisholm Essige and the President Museveni, this country will not be peaceful within these 5 years we're talking about, let alone later. So, really, it is this unanimity that the Chisholm Essige is being treated unfairly, unconstitutionally, and according to the laws of Uganda.
Justice George Kanyihamba is a retired Ugandan Supreme Court judge. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. For years, the Ethiopian government has been accused of using its anti-terrorism law to crack down on internal political dissent. Now, bloggers and political activists worry freedom of expression could be limited even further by a proposed new law. For VOA, Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
Critics of the new legislation, called the Computer Crime Proclamation, say it would widen the door for the Ethiopian government to punish individuals voicing their opinions on the internet. Daniel Berhane is a prominent blogger who also runs his own website. He believes the provisions against cybercrime in the bill could be used against anyone expressing an opinion online.
This Computer Crime Proclamation denies me the defenses, the safeguards already provided in the criminal code and in the mass media law. So it's simply more prohibitive than the existing laws. And it does that with just one sentence.
The new bill mostly focuses on cybercrime and security, but the proclamation also allows the imprisonment for those who distribute mass emails, and it gives the National Intelligence Service the power to conduct virtual investigations without approval from a judge. Belaihun Yirga of Ethiopia's Ministry of Justice says nothing will change for those who are expressing their views on the internet.
If that person is just explaining his opinions or his view, he will not be liable for crime. But the target of this law is just on the intention of the activity of the people concerning defamation. So if their purpose, the general goal is for defaming, they will be liable because defamation is law. It is a crime.
Ethiopia is often criticized for detaining, arresting and imprisoning individuals who voice their opinions online. Journalist and blogger Iskender Nega is currently serving an 18-year sentence. A group of young bloggers known as Zone 9 was detained for over a year. And Jonathan Tesfai, the spokesperson of an opposition group, has been in detention for nearly 6 months over comments he made on Facebook. Haben Fakadu of human rights group Amnesty International says the Ethiopian government is currently using the 2009 anti-terrorism proclamation to crack down on criticism.
The precedent set by Yonatan's charges are disturbing because it allows for the government to go after someone for expressing their views over social media. Yonatan was also charged under the anti-terrorism proclamation, and evidence against him was allowed to be presented and heard by the court without his knowing what that evidence was.
The new computer crime proclamation likely will be enacted in the next few weeks. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Boko Haram militants continue to try to recruit in neighboring Cameroon. The Cameroonian government and international NGOs have started giving livestock to vulnerable youth to help them earn a living and prevent them from joining the terrorist group. For the VOA, Moki Edwin Kezeka reports from the northern part of the country.
29-year-old Yegye Issa says he has not seen his only brother for a year since they were contacted by visitors to their village and offered $500 per month to join Boko Haram. Issa did not accept the offer and now takes care of his poultry farm in Cameroon's Zamai village near the northern town of Mokolo. He got started with the help of chickens provided by the government and farming advice from United Nations staff. Issa says he can now provide for his wife, three children, and 72-year-old mother. He says he is financially and physically more stable and can say without fear that the future is bright. He says he now has 60 chicks from the 9 chickens he was given, and his peers no longer insult him because he is incapable of taking care of his family. Issa is one of several hundred people who have benefited from the United Nations initiative to steer youth away from Boko Haram, which has frequently attacked northern Cameroon for the past 3 years. The coordinator of the UN system in Cameroon, Najat Rushdie, says the goal of the initiative is help the area's economy grow despite the continued violence.
Because the region was tragically and dramatically impacted by the insecurity on the one hand and the extreme violence by the other hand, it was very important actually to try to create a new dynamic, which is more of a positive dynamic, and more importantly, to provide the enabling environment for the revival of the local economy, capitalizing on the know-how of the people in the region. And obviously the know-how here is about the agriculture, is about handicraft, is about the agropastoral activities, and is about, of course, creating some community, you know, centers where actually it will be seen and acting as a platform, a community platform.
Cameroon has provided $4 million in emergency funds to create jobs for youth on its northern border with Nigeria, where the unemployment rate is over 90%. Japan has contributed $2 million to the United Nations for the second phase of the project focused on the entire conflict zone in Cameroon. Ibrahim Hamau, traditional ruler of Zamai, says the assistance has reduced delinquency among the 30,000 people he leads. He says he is grateful to the United Nations Development Program and the government of Cameroon for initiating the Resilience Project, constructing a livestock market to supply protein to both internally displaced persons and refugees, and by so doing, boost local economy and improve the living conditions of their population that grow livestock. About 100 meters from Yege Issa's poultry farm, Hamza Falama waters his 1 hectare garden.
En saison pluvieuse, on peut produire le maïs.
He says during the rainy season, they grow maize and sorghum, and when the dry season comes, they grow carrots and cabbages that enable them to send their children to school, take care of their health needs, feed their families, and save for difficult moments. Cameroon hopes to see more gardens grow and fewer difficult moments in the north in order to weaken Boko Haram. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Zamai, Northern Cameroon.
Monday is the start of the World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul, Turkey. The two-day meeting brings together representatives of government, UN agencies, NGOs, and relief efforts. They will discuss ways of improving the financing and delivery of aid to 125 million people in need of emergency assistance, including refugees and internally displaced people. Nina Nipisova is the UN representative for humanitarian and emergency affairs for World Vision International. VOA's William Eagle asked her what are some of the problems of the system for delivering relief that need to be addressed.
There are a couple of issues that we see today with the humanitarian system that could definitely be improved. One of the issues, of course, is we're facing massive shortfalls in funding. The majority of funding today goes to conflict-affected situations and protracted crises. In fact, up to 80% of funding goes there. These kind of situations don't get resolved overnight. So we're looking at a change to humanitarian financing that requires us to look at multi-year timeframes in order to address humanitarian issues that really last for years. So that's probably a really big piece of what we're trying to address. The other piece from World Vision's perspective is trying to bridge what is being dubbed as the humanitarian development divide. World Vision is a multi-mandated organization, so we very much address humanitarian issues, development issues, advocacy, and peace building. What we are proposing, for example, in our own programming, is that we will dedicate up to 20% of our development funding to be released when our national affiliates require it to respond to humanitarian crises as they arise.
Well, what's another example of where you might see a divide between the development and humanitarian partners?
I think one of the other areas that we often see is the kind of commitments to system strengthening, for example, on child protection issues or issues of health. So what we see as humanitarian industry goes in and we provide short-term interventions, what we're trying to do as World Vision is to try and link humanitarian interventions to longer-term development progress. So one of the examples that we're also going to be proposing that we're committing to is delivering up to 50% of our humanitarian assistance through a cash first approach by the year 2020, allowing us to really bridge humanitarian safety nets that are quite short-term that we can provide through cash assistance to longer-term safety nets that are linked to protection systems that really support children and families in the longer term.
One prominent NGO, Doctors Without Borders, pulled out of the summit. It said that it was not confident that any agreements at the summit would be concrete. What is your reaction to that? Are you more confident that there will be some sort of concrete action coming out of the summit and that the summit will not simply be a talk shop?
There will be several things that are going to be launched at the summit. So, for example, the Global Alliance for Urban Crises, or, for example, the Global Alliance for Humanitarian Innovation. So these are quite concrete pieces that will be taken forward in a very specific way. There are actionable steps that have been put in place and roadmaps on how people who are joining these alliances will take this forward, and World Vision is a party to both. So it is a little bit unclear, and we're hoping to get more clarity on what kind of accountability is going to be put in place following the summit.
That was Nina Nipisova of World Vision International. She spoke with viewers William Eagle.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin in Britain at the Great Manchester Run. Three-time Olympic champion Kenenisha Bekele has won the men's race at the Great Manchester Run, finishing the 10-kilometer course in a time of 28 minutes and 8 seconds. Kenya's Wilson Kipsang came second. In the women's race, Bekele's fellow Ethiopian Tironisha Dibaba beat Kenyan Edna Kiplagat, finishing in 31 minutes and 16 seconds. Richard Goodman and Gemma Steele were the highest-placed Britons in 6th and 8th, respectively. The men's and women's elite races developed in near-identical fashion, with a group of three athletes quickly establishing a lead over the field. And Bekele and Dibaba both displayed their superiority in the final kilometers, easing clear of their Kenyan rivals to finish comfortably ahead. The wheelchair races were dominated by British athletes, with Simon Lawson finishing nearly 3 minutes ahead of second-placed Brett Crossley, while Shelley Woods won a close-fought women's contest 14 seconds in front of Jed Jones. Meanwhile, world marathon champion Maya Dibaba is one of six athletes who will represent Ethiopia in the marathon at the Rio 2016 Olympic Games. The Ethiopian Athletics Federation has confirmed its selection, along with several reserves, for both the men's and women's marathon. The men's team comprises the winners of three of the world's biggest marathons so far this year: Dubai Marathon champion Tesfaye Abera, Boston Marathon champion Lemi Behanu, and Tokyo Marathon champion Feisa Lelisa. Three-time Olympic champion Kenenisha Bekele, who finished third at this year's London Marathon, has been named as a reserve, along with world silver medalist Adehane Yamene and 2013 world silver medalist Lelisha Desisa. Dibaba, who equaled her lifetime best of 2 hours, 19 minutes and 52 seconds when winning last year's Xiamen Marathon, is joined on the women's team by two-time Berlin Marathon champion Aberu Kabede and three-time Dubai Marathon winner Aslefech Mejia. Dubai Marathon champion Tefi Segaye, who clocked a world-leading 2 hours, 19 minutes and 41 seconds earlier this year, and Tigista Tufa, who won the 2015 London Marathon and finished second in this year's race, are the reserves for the women's team. And in football, Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel and Young Africans of Tanzania both lost their Confederation Cup second legs 1-0, but progressed the group phase with a 2-1 aggregate win. Louis Ameka Achanga gave Gabon's Manana hope against reigning champions Etoile when he scored for the hosts 4 minutes before halftime. Etoile held on to advance thanks to their 2-0 win at home 10 days ago. Medeam of Ghana booked their place in the group phase after an impressive 2-0 win over South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns in Sekondi, which put the hosts through on the away goals rule. Trailing 3-1 from the first leg, Medeama were the underdogs going into their return match at home. But a penalty from Malik Akwushu, followed by a Bernard Ofiri goal, made it 3-all on aggregate and gave Medeama an away goals victory. Al Ahli Tripoli of Libya scored a late equalizer in Egypt against Misri El Makasha to progress, also on away goals. Penalties were decisive in Morocco, where Kaukab Marrakech scored two of them to beat Sudanese giants Al Merrikh 2-0. And there will be two Morocco sides in the draw on Tuesday, May 24th, because FUS Rabat put in a fine winning performance at home against Stade Malien, taking the game 4-0. Finally, in boxing, undefeated brothers Jamal and Jamel Chalo of Houston became the first twins in boxing history to hold world titles in the same weight class. Jamal Chalo, whose record stands at 24 wins with no losses and 18 wins coming by way of knockout, retained his IBF Junior Middleweight World Championship with a unanimous 12-round decision over former world champion Austin No Doubt Trout of New Mexico. In the opening bout of the three fights telecast, Jamal Chalo, whose record stands at 28 wins with no losses and 13 wins coming by way of knockouts, and the vacant WBC Super Welterweight World Championship by rallying from 5 points down to register an eighth-round knockout over John Darock Jackson of St. Thomas, Virgin Islands. Born 1 minute apart, the identical twins celebrated their 26th birthday this past Thursday, May 19th, and Jamal is 1 minute older than Jamel. In the other fight of the night, Zlanda Lara beat Van Matriasan. Lara successfully defended his WBA Super Welterweight Championship with a hard-fought 12-round unanimous decision. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
Star and the queen of my area. If you tell me you will stay tonight, nobody can love you better. If you want me to my mama, oh baby, why buy me low? You call me like say I did, press on my baby too much, make me say yeah, I say yeah, I say yeah, I say yeah, I try. I don't fall in love with you, hey, baby. Jammer, thank you for bringing this girl in my life.
And when you need me, girl, you know, send me, girl, always on time.
And girl, you need to know, for you, me go the extra mile.
And when the haters try to diss, you don't say nothing, just smile.
Late nights, blackberry golden. Yeah. Now, baby, love, I am the one you should be holding.
Yeah.
Late nights, blackberry golden.
Yeah.
With every message, girl, my heart is unfolding.
If you tell me you will stay tonight, nobody can love you better. I'll be a groupie. You're my star and the queen of my area. If you tell me you will stay tonight, nobody can love you better. If you want me to my mama, oh baby, why buy me low? You call me like say I didn't press on my baby too much. Make me say yeah, I 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 don't fall in love with you, babe.
Girls, them view me flow.
Me flow.
I wanna make you mine.
You mine.
Cause I feel you die. I'm feeling the way that you rocking, girl. No deny, no stopping, girl. Me and you to the top, we rolling. Boys keep calling, but you keep them holding. Hey, I, you can have whatever you like. Baby girl, please be mine. I get you everything that you like.
I'm a
you too much. Make me say yeah, I say yeah, I say yeah, I say yeah, I say.
Oh,
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Is African presidents and the close collaborators were as resourceful and imaginative in the eradication of poverty in the countries as they are in devising schemes to prolong their stay in office, then the economy of Africa would be booming. Sadly, this is not always the case. More often than not, the goals for the people are more parochial. The latest in the scheme to prolong an African president in office came in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. A court ruled that President Kabila could stay in office beyond the day specified in the constitution. Mind you, the court did not talk about having a third term or changing the constitution, but the implications are very strange, because it would only mean that the president and his collaborators would have to make it so difficult for agreement to be reached for the next election that he could continue in office forever. Don't forget what happened in La Côte d'Ivoire with Gbagbo. This was what really happened, and we know what the consequences are. This issue of staying in office beyond the two terms is a burning one in Africa. Africans are divided. There are Africans who believe that the two terms limit is counterproductive. They point to mature democracy in Europe and tell you that many of the leaders stay for a lengthy period in office. What they do not take into account is the fact that in Africa, following independence in the 1960s, we had charismatic leaders who had helped to achieve independence, who could in fact stay as long as they wish in office. But this changed dramatically when these same leaders consider opposition to their policy as enemies. We then move to the so-called one-party state, which means they feel that this would unify the nation. From one-party state, we move on to president for life. But after the end of the Cold War, democracy swept through Africa, and Africans chose the model of two terms of a head of state. Generally speaking, this has helped in most parts of Africa. In South Africa, after the end of apartheid in 1994, they still have two terms. In Nigeria, they have two terms after they were able to oppose the request of Obasanjo for a third term. And then, of course, we know what happened in Burkina Faso, when Blaise Compaoré lost everything because he tried to change the constitution to go for a new term. The real problem then is in Central and East Africa. And in Central and East Africa, the issue of term limitation has not held. We have just had voting in Uganda, when Museveni, after a lengthy period in office, has been again elected for a further term. We have the case in Rwanda, where it is more than likely that the president will go beyond two terms. And we know what are the consequences of Nkurunziza's foolish idea of going for a third term, but using a different argument that the agreement which was reached should not start at the time it did, but it must now finish that term. But we know the consequences. And in the DRC, we know that the opposition and the students are very clear that they would resist at all costs any attempt by the president to stay 1 hour beyond the term of office. So this prolongation of office has quite often created problems in Africa in terms of crisis. So it is not just extending it, but there are consequences. And I think Africans should bear that in mind. In Sierra Leone, there was also a new attempt, which we did not know whether this comes from the president, but supporters were talking about more time for lost time. And the idea was that during the Ebola period, the president lost time, and therefore he should have an additional time. Across Sierra Leone in Liberia, where they also had Ebola, we have not had any talk about more time for lost time. And therefore, we have to see how things are going. But the question of this prolongation is not just a matter of style. It can have serious political consequences in terms of conflict. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, the ever affable Michael Dubinsky. We say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, it is the wandering dog that finds the old bone. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Ethiopia is facing the worst drought the country has experienced in half a century. Triggered by El Nino, the drought follows two consecutive poor harvests, a disaster in this country of 90 million people, where the vast majority subsist on rain-dependent agriculture. In the worst-hit areas, the drought has killed nearly all crops. Failed crops means little food for people and no fodder for livestock, causing cattle to die by the hundreds of thousands. And then in April, torrential rains began to drench the cement-hard soil of the parched Ethiopian countryside, causing flooding and displacing thousands of people. Today, some 10 to 20 million Ethiopians are in need of aid. An estimated 435,000 children need treatment for severe acute malnutrition, and up to 2.5 million children, pregnant women, and nursing mothers are in need of supplementary feeding. The United States announced that it is adding $128 million to the more than $570 million we have already delivered to Ethiopia, said Acting Assistant Administrator for the Bureau of Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Affairs, Thomas Stahl. This new funding underscores the United States' commitment to working with Ethiopia to prevent this drought from becoming a humanitarian catastrophe, he said. The funds will provide fundamental humanitarian aid, including relief, food assistance, safe drinking water, malnutrition treatment, mobile health teams, and seeds for planting. This contribution supports the food requirement needed for the next three critical months. But so much more is needed. Ethiopia has requested aid to the tune of $1.4 billion. The United States is delivering vitally important humanitarian aid to the Ethiopian people, and we call on our friends and partners to join us in alleviating this potential humanitarian disaster.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.